Chapter 38. In year 14, we had April Fish Day as usual. On that day, you were supposed to act silly and laugh a lot. I pinned a fish onto Shacky, and Croge pinned a fish onto me, and Shacky pinned a fish onto Amanda. A lot of kids pinned fish onto Nuala, but nobody pinned a fish onto Toby, because you couldn't get behind her without her knowing. Adam 1 pinned a fish onto himself to make some point about God. That little brat Oates ran around shouting, "Fish fingers!" and poking his fingers into people from behind until Rebecca made him stop. Then he was sad, so I took him into the corner and told him the story about the littlest vulture. He was a sweet boy when he wasn't being a pest. Zeb was away on one of his trips. He'd been going away more lately. Lucerne stayed home. She said she had nothing to celebrate, and it was a stupid festival anyway. It was my first April fish without Bernice. We'd always decorated a fish cake together when we were little, before Amanda arrived. We'd fight all the time about what to put on it. Once we'd made our cake green, with spinach for the green color, with eyes of carrot rounds. It looked really toxic. Thinking about that cake made me want to cry. Where was Bernice now? I felt ashamed of myself for being so unkind to her. What if she was dead, like Bert? If she was, it was partly my fault. Mostly my fault. My fault. Amanda and I walked back to the cheese factory, and Shacky and Croge walked with us, to protect us, they said. Amanda laughed at that, but said they could come with us if they liked. The four of us were more or less friends again, though every once in a while Croge would say to Amanda, "You still owe us," and Amanda would tell him to get knotted. By the time we got back to the cheese factory, it was dark. We thought we'd be in trouble for being so late. Lucerne was always warning us about the dangers of the street. But it turned out that Zeb was back, and already they were having a fight. So we went into the hall to wait it out, because their fights took up all the room in our place. This fight was louder than usual. A piece of furniture toppled over, or was thrown. Lucerne, it must have been, because Zeb wasn't a thrower. "What's it about?" I said to Amanda. She had her ear against the door. She was shameless about eavesdropping. "I don't know," she said. "She's yelling too loud. Oh, wait. She says he's having sex with Nuala."
"Not Nuala," I said. "He wouldn't."
Now I knew how Bernice must have felt when we'd said all that about her father. "Men'll have sex with anything given the chance," said Amanda. "Now she's saying he's a pimp at heart, and he despises her and treats her like shit. I think she's crying."
"Maybe we should stop listening," I said.
"Okay," said Amanda. We stayed with our backs against the wall, waiting until Lucerne would start wailing, as she always did. Then Zeb would stomp out and slam the door, and we might not see him for days. Zeb came out.
"See you around, queens of the night," he said. "Watch your backs."
He was joking with us the way he liked to do, but there wasn't any fun behind it. He looked grim. Usually after their fights, Lucerne would go to bed and cry, but this night she started packing a bag. The bag was a pink backpack Amanda and I had gleaned. There wasn't much for Lucerne to put into it, so quite soon she finished her packing and came into our cubicle. Amanda and I were pretending to be asleep on our husk-filled futons under our blue jean quilts.
"Get up, Ren," Lucerne said to me. "We're going."
"Where?"
I said.
"Back," she said, "to the Healthwiser compound."
"Right now?"
"Yes."
"Why are you looking like that? It's what you've always wanted."
It's true that I'd longed for the Healthwiser compound once. I'd been homesick for it. But ever since Amanda'd moved in, I hadn't been thinking about it too much.
"Amanda's coming too?"
I said. Amanda's staying here. I felt very cold.
I want Amanda to come, I said.
Out of the question, said Lucerne. Something else had now happened, it seemed. Lucerne had cast off her paralyzing spell, the spell of Zeb. She'd stepped out of sex, as if out of a loose dress. Now she was brisk, decisive, no nonsense. Had she been like that before, long ago? I could scarcely remember.
Why?
I said.
Why can't Amanda come?
Because they won't let her in at Healthwiser. We can get our identities back there, but she doesn't have one, and I certainly don't have the money to buy her one. They'll take care of her here, she added, as if Amanda was a kitten I was being forced to abandon.
No way, I said. If she's not coming, I'm not.
And where would you live? Here? Said Lucerne with contempt.
We'll stay with Zeb, I said.
He's never home, said Lucerne. You don't think they'd let two young girls camp out by themselves?
Then we can live with Adam One, I said, or Nuala, or maybe Katuro.
Or Stuart the Screw, said Amanda hopefully. This was desperate. Stuart was dour and a loner, but I grabbed the idea.
We can help him make furniture, I said.
I imagined the whole scenario. Amanda and me collecting pieces of junk for Stuart, sawing and hammering and singing as we worked, making herbal tea.
You won't be welcome, said Lucerne.
Stuart is a misanthrope. He only tolerates you kids because of Zeb, and it's the same with all the others.
We'll stay with Toby, I said.
Toby has other things to do. Now that's enough. If Amanda can't find someone who'll take her in, she can always go back to the plea brats. She belongs with them anyway. You don't. Now hurry up.
I need to put on my clothes, I said.
Fine, said Lucerne. 10 minutes. She left the cubicle.
What'll we do?
I whispered to Amanda as I started to dress.
I don't know,
Amanda whispered back.
Once you're in there, she'll never let you out. Those compounds are like castles. They're like jails. She won't ever let you see me. She hates me.
I don't care what she thinks, I whispered.
I'll get out somehow.
My phone, Amanda whispered. Take it with you. You can phone me.
I'll get you in somehow, I said.
By this time I was crying, silently. I slipped her purple phone into my pocket.
Hurry up, Wren, said Lucerne.
I'll call you, I whispered. My dad will buy you an identity.
Sure he will, said Amanda softly. Don't take shit, okay? In the main room, Lucerne was moving fast. She dumped out the sickly-looking tomato plant she'd been growing on the windowsill. Underneath the soil, there was a plastic bag full of money. She must have been ripping it off from selling stuff at the Tree of Life, the soap, the vinegar, the macrame, the quilts. Money was old-fashioned, but people still used it for small things, and the gardeners wouldn't take virtual money because they didn't allow computers. So she'd been stashing away her escape money. She hadn't been such a doormat as I'd thought. Then she took the kitchen shears and cut off her long hair straight across at neck level. The cutting made a Velcro sound, scratchy and dry. She left the pile of hair in the middle of the dining room table. Then she took me by the arm and hauled me out of our place and down the stairs. She never went out at night because of the drunks and druggies on the street corners and the plea brat gangs and muggers. But right then she was white hot with anger and filled with crackling energy. People on the street cleared out of our path as if we were contagious, and even the Asian fusions and the blackened redfish left us alone. It took us hours to get through the sinkhole and the sewage lagoon, and then the richer plebes. As we went along, the houses and buildings and hotels got newer looking, and the streets emptier of people. In Big Box, we got a solar cab. We drove through golf greens and then past a big open space, and finally right up to the gates of the Healthwiser compound. It was so long since I'd seen that place, it was like one of those dreams where you don't recognize anything, yet also you do. I felt a little sick, but that might have been excitement. Before we got into the cab, Lucerne had mussed up my hair and smeared dirt on her own face and torn part of her dress. "Why'd you do that?" I said. But she didn't answer. There were two guards at the Healthwiser gateway, behind the little window.
"Identities?" they said.
"We don't have any," said Lucerne. "They were stolen. We were forcibly abducted." She looked behind her as if she was afraid someone was following us. "Please, you have to let us in, right away. My husband, he's in nanobioforms. He'll tell you who I am." She started to cry. One of them reached for the phone, pushed a button.
"Frank," he said. "Main gate. Lady here says she's your wife." "We'll need some cheek swabs, ma'am, for the communicables," said the second one. "Then you can wait in the holding room pending bioform clearance and verification. Someone will be with you soon."
In the holding room, we sat on a black vinyl sofa. It was 5 in the morning. Lucerne picked up a magazine. "New Skins," it said on the cover. "Why live with imperfection?" She riffled through it.
"Were we forcibly abducted?" I asked her.
"Oh, my darling," she said. "You don't remember. You were too young. I didn't want to tell you. I didn't want you to be frightened. They might have done something terrible to you." Then she began to cry again, harder. By the time the corpsey man in the biosuit walked in, her face was all streaky. Chapter 39. "Be careful what you wish for," old Pilar used to say. I was back at the Healthwiser compound, and I was reunited with my father, just as I used to wish, long ago. But nothing felt right. All that faux marble, and the reproduction antique furniture, and the carpets in our house, none of it seemed real. It smelled funny, too, like disinfectant. I missed the leafy smells of the gardeners, the cooking smells, even the sharp vinegar tang, even the violet violets. My father, Frank, hadn't changed my room, but the four-poster bed and the pink curtains looked shrunken. It also looked too young for me. There were the plush animals I'd once loved so much, but their glass eyes looked dead. I stuffed them into the back of my closet so they wouldn't be able to look through me as if I was a shadow. The first night, Lucerne ran a bath for me with fake flower bath essence in it. The big white tub and the white fluffy towels made me feel dirty and also stinky. I stank like earth, compost earth, before it's finished. That sour odor. Also, my skin was blue. It was the dye from the gardener clothes. I'd never really noticed it, because the showers at the gardener's were so brief and there weren't any mirrors. I hadn't noticed either how hairy I'd become, and that was more of a shock than my blue skin. I rubbed and rubbed at the blue. It wouldn't come off. I looked at my toes, where they stuck up out of the bathwater. The toenails looked like claws.
"Let's put some polish on those," Lucerne said 2 days later, when she saw my feet in flip-flops.
She was acting as if none of it had ever happened. Not the gardeners, not Amanda, and especially not Zeb. She was wearing crisp linen suits. She'd had her hair styled and streaked. She'd already had her own toes done. She'd wasted no time.
"Look at all these colors I bought for you. Green, purple, frosted orange, and I got you some sparkly ones."
But I was angry with her, and I turned away. She was such a liar. All those years I'd kept an outline of my father in my head, like a chalk line enclosing a father-shaped space, When I was little, I'd colored it in often enough. But those colors had been too bright, and the outline had been too large. Frank was shorter, grayer, balder, and more confused-looking than what I'd had in mind. Before he'd come to the Healthwiser Gatehouse to identify us, I'd thought he'd be overjoyed to find that we were safe and sound and not dead after all. But when he saw me, his face fell. Now I realized that he'd last known me when I was a small girl, so I was bigger than he expected, and probably bigger than he wanted. I was also shabbier. Despite the drab gardener clothes, I must have looked like one of the plea brats he might have seen running around if he'd ever been to the sinkhole or the sewage lagoon. Maybe he was afraid I was going to pick his pockets or grab his shoes. He approached me as if I might bite and put his arms awkwardly around me. He smelled of complex chemicals, the kind of chemicals used for cleaning off sticky things like glue. A smell that could burn right down into your lungs. On that first night, I slept for 12 hours, and when I woke up, I found that Lucerne had taken away my gardener clothes and burnt them. Luckily, I'd hidden Amanda's purple phone inside the plush tiger in my closet. I'd cut open the stomach, so the phone didn't get burnt. I missed the smell of my own skin, which had lost its salty flavor and was now soapy and perfumey. I thought about what Zeb used to say about mice. If you take them out of the mouse nest for a while and then put them back, the other mice will tear them apart. If I went back to the gardener's with my fake flower smell, would they tear me apart? Lucerne took me to the Healthwiser Inn clinic so I could be checked for head lice and worms and for being interfered with. That meant a couple of fingers up you, front and back. "Oh my goodness," the doctor said when he saw my blue skin. "Are these bruises, dear?" "No," I said. "It's dye."
"Oh," he said. "They made you dye yourself?"
"It's in the clothes," I said.
"I see," he said.
Then he made an appointment for me with the in-clinic psychiatrist, who had experience with people who'd been snatched by cults. My mother would have to be at those appointments as well, which was how I found out what Lucerne was telling them. We'd been grabbed off the street while in solar space doing some boutique shopping, but she couldn't say exactly where we'd been taken because she'd never been allowed to know. She said it wasn't the fault of the cult itself. It was one of the male members who'd been obsessed with her and wanted her for his personal sex slave, and had taken away her shoes to keep her captive. This was supposed to be Zeb, though she said she didn't know his name. I'd been too young to realize what was going on, she said, but I'd been a hostage. She'd had to do the bidding of this madman, service his every twisted whim. It was revolting the things he'd made her do, or my life would have been in danger. But she'd finally been able to share her plight with one of the other cult members, a sort of nun. She must have meant Toby. It was this woman who helped her to escape, brought her shoes, given her money, lured the madman away so Lucerne could make a dash for freedom. It was no use asking me anything, she said. The cult members had been nice to me, and anyway, they'd been duped. She'd been the only one who'd known the truth. It was a burden she'd had to carry alone. What woman who loved her child as much as she loved me wouldn't have done the same? Before our psychiatry sessions, she'd squeeze my shoulder and say, "Amanda's back there. Keep that in mind." Meaning that if I told anyone she'd been lying her hair off, she'd suddenly remember where she'd been imprisoned, and the Corpsey Corps would go in there with their spray guns and who knew what might happen. Bystanders got killed a lot in spray gun attacks. It couldn't be helped, said the Corpsey Corps. It was in the interests of public order. For weeks, Lucerne hovered around to make sure I wouldn't try to run away or else rat on her. But at last, I got a chance to take out Amanda's purple phone and call. Amanda had texted me with the number of the new phone she'd lifted, so I'd know where to reach her. She thought ahead about everything. I sat inside my closet to make the call. It had a light inside, like all the closets in the house. The closet itself was as big as my former sleeping cubicle. Amanda answered right away. There she was on the screen, looking the same as ever. I longed to be back at the gardener's.
I really miss you, I said. I'm running away as soon as I can.
But I didn't know when that would be, I said, because Lucerne was keeping my identity locked in a drawer, and I wouldn't be allowed past the gatehouse without it.
Can't you trade? Said Amanda. With the guards?
No, I said. I don't think so. It's different here.
Oh.
What happened to your hair?
Lucerne made me cut it.
It looks okay, said Amanda. Then she said,
They found Bert, dumped in the vacant lot out behind Scales. He had freezer burns.
He'd been in a freezer?
What was left?
There were parts missing. Liver, kidneys, heart. Zeb says the mobs will sell the parts, then keep the rest in the freezer until they need to send a message.
Wren, where are you?
It was Lucerne in my room.
I have to go,
I whispered. I tucked the phone back into the Tiger.
In here,
I said. My teeth were chattering. Freezers were so cold.
What are you doing in the closet, darling? Said Lucerne. Come and have some lunch. You'll feel better soon.
She sounded chirpy. The crazier and more disturbed I acted, the better it was for her, because the less anyone would believe me if I told on her. Her story was that I'd been traumatized by being stuck in among the warped, brainwashing cult folk. I had no way of proving her wrong. Anyway, maybe I had been traumatized. I had nothing to compare myself with.
Chapter 40. Once I'd adjusted enough, adjusted was the word they used, as if I was a bra strap, Lucerne said I had to go to school, because it was bad for me to be moping around the house. I needed to get out and make a whole new life for myself, as she was doing. It was a risk for her. I was a walking cluster bomb. The truth about her might come popping out of my mouth at any time. But she knew I was judging her silently, and that annoyed her, so she really wanted me elsewhere. Frank seemed to have believed her story, though he didn't seem to care about it one way or the other. I could see now why Lucerne had run off with Zeb. At least Zeb had noticed her. And he'd noticed me as well, whereas Frank treated me like a window. He never looked at me, only through me. Sometimes I dreamed about Zeb. He'd be wearing a bear suit, and the fur would unzip down the middle like a pajama bag, and Zeb would step out. He'd smell comforting in the dream, like rained-on grass and cinnamon and the salty, vinegary, singed leaf smell of the gardeners. The school was called Healthwiser High. On the first day, I put on one of the new outfits that Lucerne had picked out for me. It was pink and lemon yellow, colors the gardeners never would have allowed because they'd show the dirt and waste the soap. My new clothes felt like a disguise. I couldn't get used to how tight they were compared to my old loose dresses, and how my bare arms stuck out from the sleeves and my bare legs came out from the bottom of the knee-length pleated skirt. But this was what the girls at Healthwiser High all wore, according to Lucerne.
Don't forget your sunblock, Brenda, she said as I headed towards the door.
She was calling me Brenda now. She claimed it was my real name. Healthwiser sent a student to be my guide, walk me to the school, show me around. Her name was Wakula Price. She was thin, with glossy skin like toffee. She was wearing a pastel yellow top like mine, but she had pants on the bottom. She gazed at my pleated skirt, her eyes wide.
I like your skirt, she said.
My mother bought it, I said.
Oh, she said in a sorry voice. My mother bought me one like that 2 years ago. So I liked her.
On the way to school, Wakula said, What does your dad do? When did you get here? And so on. But she didn't mention any cults. And I said, how do you like the school? Who are the teachers? And that got us safely there. The houses we were passing were all different styles, but with solar skins. They had the latest tech in the compounds, which Lucerne had pointed out a lot. Really, Brenda, they're so much more truly green than those purist gardeners, so you don't have to worry about how much hot water you're using, and isn't it time you took another shower? The high school building was sparkling clean. No graffiti, no pieces falling off, no smashed windows. It had a deep green lawn with some shrubs pruned into round balls, and a statue. Florence Nightingale, it said on the plaque. The Lady of the Lamp. But someone had changed the A to a U, so it said, The Lady of the Lump. Jimmy did that, said Wakula. He's my lab partner in Nanoforms Biotech. He's always doing dumb things like that. She smiled. She had really white teeth. Lucerne had been saying how dingy my own teeth were, and I needed a cosmetic dentist. She was already planning to redecorate our entire house, but she had some alterations planned for me as well. At least I didn't have any cavities. The gardeners were against refined sugar products and were strict about brushing, though you had to use a frayed twig because they hated the idea of putting either plastic or animal bristles inside their mouths. The first morning at that school was very strange. I felt as if the classes were in a foreign language. All the subjects were different, the words were different, and then there were the computers and the paper notebooks. I had a built-in fear of those. It seemed so dangerous, all that permanent writing that your enemies could find. You couldn't just wipe it away, not like a slate. I wanted to run into the washroom and wash my hands after touching the keyboards and pages. The danger had surely rubbed off on me. Lucerne said that our so-called personal history, the forcible abduction and so on, would be kept confidential by the officials at the Healthwiser compound. But someone had leaked, because the kids at school all knew. At least they hadn't heard about Lucerne's sex-slave-lust-mad pervert story. But I knew I'd lie about that if I had to, in order to protect Amanda and Zeb and Adam One, and even the ordinary gardeners. We are all in one another's hands, Adam One used to say. I was beginning to find out what that meant. At lunch hour, a group gathered around me. Not a mean group, just curious. So you lived with a cult? Weird. How crazy were they? They had a lot of questions. Meanwhile, they were eating their lunches, and there was meat smell everywhere. Bacon. Fish sticks, 20% real fish. Burgers, they were called wise burgers, and they were made of meat cultured on stretchy racks, so no animals had actually been killed, but it still smelled like meat. Amanda would have eaten the bacon to show she hadn't been brainwashed by the leaf eaters, but I couldn't go that far. I peeled the bun off my wise burger and tried to eat that, but it stank of dead animal. Like, how bad was it? Said Wakula. It was just a greenie cult, I said. Like the Wolf Isaiahists? Said one kid. Were they terrorists? They all leaned forward. They wanted horror stories. No, they were pacifists, I said. We had to work on this rooftop garden. And I told them about the slug and snail relocation. It sounded so strange to me when I told it. At least you didn't eat them, said one girl. Some of those cults, they eat roadkill.
The Wolf Isaiahs do, for sure. It was on the web.
You lived in the plebes, though? Cool. Then I realized I had an edge, because I'd lived in the plebe lands where none of them had ever been, except maybe on a school trip, or dragged along with their slumming parents to the Tree of Life. So I could make up whatever I liked.
You were child labor, one boy said. A little enviro-surf. Sexy.
They all laughed. Jimmy, don't be so dumb, said Wakula. It's okay, she said to me. He always says stuff like that. Jimmy grinned.
Did you worship cabbages? He went on. Oh, great cabbage! I kiss your cabbagey cabbageness.
He went down on one knee and grabbed a handful of my pleated skirt.
Nice leaves. Do they come off?
Don't be such a meat breath, I said.
A what? He said, laughing. A meat breath?
Then I had to explain how that was a harsh name to call someone among the extreme greens. Like pig eater, like slug face. This made Jimmy laugh more. I saw the temptation. I saw it clearly. I would come up with more bizarre details about my cultish life, and then I would pretend that I thought all these things were as warped as the Healthwiser kids did. That would be popular. But also I saw myself the way the Adams and the Eves would see me, with sadness, with disappointment. Adam won, and Toby and Rebecca, and Pilar, even though she was dead, and even Zeb. How easy it is. Treachery. You just slide into it. But I knew that already, because of Bernice. Wakula walked home with me, and Jimmy came too. He fooled around a lot, made jokes, expected us to laugh. And Wakula did laugh, in a polite way. I could see that Jimmy had a big crush on her, though Wakula told me later that she couldn't see Jimmy in any way other than as a friend. Wakula turned off halfway to go to her house, and Jimmy said he'd continue along with me because it was on the way. He was irritating when there was more than one other person. Maybe he felt it was better to make a fool of yourself than to have other people do it for you. But when he wasn't putting on an act, he was much nicer. I could tell he was sad underneath, because I was that way myself. We were sort of like twins in that way, or so I felt at the time. He was the first boy I'd ever really had for a friend.
So it must be weird for you being here in a compound after the plebe lands, he said one day.
Yeah, I said.
Was your mom really tied to the bed by a deranged maniac? Jimmy would come right out with stuff other people might think, but would never say.
Where did you hear that? I said.
Locker room, said Jimmy. So Lucerne's fable had seeped out. I took a deep breath.
This is between us, right?
Cross my heart, said Jimmy.
No, I said. She wasn't tied to the bed.
Didn't think so, said Jimmy.
But don't tell that to anyone. I really trust you not to.
I won't, said Jimmy. He didn't say why not.
He knew that if everyone heard Lucerne had been bullshitting, people would know she hadn't been kidnapped. She'd merely cheated big time. What she'd done had been for love, or just sex, and she was back at Healthwiser with her loser of a husband because the other guy had tossed her over. But she'd rather die than admit it, or else she'd rather kill someone. All this time I was going into my closet and taking the purple cell phone out of my Tiger and phoning Amanda. We'd text each other with the best times to call, and if the connection was good, we could see each other on screen. I asked a lot of questions about the Gardeners. Amanda told me she wasn't staying with Zeb anymore. Adam One said she was almost grown up, so she had to sleep in one of the singles cubicles, and that was pretty boring.
When can you get back here? She said.
But I didn't know how I could manage to run away from Healthwiser.
I'm working on it, I said.
The next time we were on the phone, she said,
Look who's here.
And it was Shacky, grinning at me sheepishly, and I wondered if they'd been having sex together. I felt as if Amanda had scooped some glittery piece of junk I wanted for myself, but that was stupid because I had no feelings for Shacky whatsoever. I did wonder whether it had been his hand on my bum that night I passed out in the hollow spinner, but most likely it was Croge.
How's Croge? I said to Shacky. And Oats?
They're fine, Shacky mumbled. When are you coming back? Croge really misses you. Gang, right?
Green, I said. Gangrene.
I was surprised he'd still use that old kid stuff password, but maybe Amanda had put him up to it so I'd feel included. After Shaggy went off screen, Amanda said they were partners. The two of them were boosting things from malls. But it was a fair trade. She got someone watching her back and helping her lift stuff and sell it, and he got sex.
Don't you love him? I said.
Amanda said I was a romantic. She said love was useless because it led you into dumb exchanges in which you gave too much away, and then you got bitter and mean. Chapter 41. Jimmy and I started doing our homework together. He was really nice about helping me with the parts I didn't know. Because of all that memorizing we'd had to do at the gardener's, I could stare at a lesson and then see everything inside my head, like a picture. So although it was hard for me, and I felt I was way behind, I started to catch up quite fast. Because he was 2 years ahead of me, Jimmy wasn't in any of my classes, except for life skills, which was supposed to help you structure your life once you had one. They mixed up the age groups in life skills, so we could benefit from sharing our different life experiences, and Jimmy traded desks so he was sitting right behind me. "I'm your bodyguard," he whispered, which made me feel safe. We went to my place to do our homework if Lucerne wasn't there. If she was, we went to Jimmy's. I liked Jimmy's place better because he had a pet raccoon. It was a new splice, half skunk but without the smell, half raccoon but without the aggression. Her name was Killer. She was one of the first ones they'd made. When I picked her up, she liked me right away. Jimmy's mother seemed to like me as well, though the first time she saw me, she looked at me very hard with her stern blue eyes and asked me how old I was. I liked her all right, too, although she smoked too much, which made me cough. Nobody at the gardener's smoked, or at least not cigarettes. She worked on a computer a lot, but I couldn't figure out what she did on it because she didn't have a job. His father was hardly ever there. He was at the labs, figuring out how to transplant human stem cells and DNA into pigs to grow new human pieces. I asked Jimmy what pieces, and he said kidneys, but maybe it was lungs too. In the future, you'd be able to get your very own pig made with second copies of everything. I knew what the gardeners would think of that. They would think it was bad because of having to kill the pigs. Jimmy had seen these pigs. Their nickname was Pigoon, like pig balloon, because they were so big. The double organ methods were proprietary secrets, he said, extra valuable. "Aren't you worried some foreign corpse will kidnap your dad and squeeze the secrets out of his brain?" I said. That was happening more often. They kept it out of the news, but there was gossip at Healthwiser. Sometimes they got the kidnapped scientists back. Sometimes they didn't. The security was getting tighter and tighter. After doing our homework, Jimmy and I would hang out at the Healthwiser Mall and play tame video games and drink Happy Cappuccinos. The first time, I told him Happy Cuppa was the brew of evil, so I couldn't drink it, and he laughed at me. The second time, I made an effort, and it tasted delicious, and soon I wasn't thinking too much about the evilness of it. After a while, Jimmy talked to me about Wakula Price. He said she was the first girl he'd ever been in love with, but when he'd asked her to get serious with him, she'd said they could only be friends. I knew that part already, but I said that was too bad. And Jimmy said he'd been a puddle of dog vomit for weeks, and he still hadn't got over it. Then he asked me if I had a boyfriend back in the plebes, and I said yes, which wasn't true. But since I had no way of getting back there, I decided to forget about him because that was the best thing to do if you wanted someone you couldn't have. Jimmy was really sympathetic about my lost boyfriend, and he squeezed my hand. Then I felt guilty for telling such a lie. But I wasn't sorry about the squeezing. By this time, I had a diary. All the girls at school had them. It was a retro craze.
People could hack your computer, but they couldn't hack a paper book. I wrote all of this down in my diary. It was like talking to someone. I didn't even think that writing things down was that dangerous anymore. I guess that shows how far away from the gardeners I'd grown already. I kept my diary in the closet, inside a stuffed bear, because I didn't want Lucerne snooping on me. The gardeners were right about that part. Reading someone else's secret words does give you power over them. Then a new boy came to Healthwiser High. His name was Glenn, and as soon as I saw him, I knew he was the same Glenn who'd come to the Tree of Life on the St. Yule's week when Amanda and I had walked him over with that jar of honey to visit Pilar. I thought he gave me a little nod. Did he recognize me? I hope not, because I didn't want him to start talking about where he'd seen me last. What if the Corpsey Corps were still trying to track down Lucerne's pretend sex slaver? What if they found Zeb through me, and he ended up without his parts in a freezer? That was a horrifying thought. But surely, even if he did remember me, Glenn wouldn't say anything, because he wouldn't want them finding out about Pilar and the gardeners and whatever he'd been doing with them. I was sure it was something illegal, or why would Pilar have sent Amanda and me away? It must have been to protect us. Glenn acted like he didn't care about anybody, him and his black T-shirts. But after a while, Jimmy started hanging out with him, and then I wasn't seeing so much of Jimmy. "What do you do with that Glenn? He's creepy," I said one afternoon when we were doing our homework on the school library computers. Jimmy said they only played three-dimensional chess or online video games at his place or else at Glenn's. I thought they were probably watching porn. Most of the guys did, and a lot of girls, too. So I asked, what games? "Barbarian Stomp," he said. That was a war game. "Blood and Roses" was like Monopoly, only you had to corner the genocide and atrocity market. "Extinctathon" was a trivia game you played with extinct animals. "Maybe I could come over one day and play too," I said, but he didn't go for that, so I guessed that they really were watching porn. Then a really bad thing happened. Jimmy's mother disappeared. Not kidnapped, they said. She'd gone on her own. I heard Lucerne talking about it to Frank. It seemed that Jimmy's mother had made off with a lot of crucial data, so the Corpsey Corps were all over Jimmy's house like a rash. "And since Jimmy was such a buddy of mine," said Lucerne, "they might soon be swarming all over us as well. Not that we had anything to hide, but it would be a nuisance." I texted Jimmy right away and said how sorry I was about his mother and was there anything I could do. He wasn't at school, but he texted me later that week, then came over to my place. He was very depressed. It was bad enough that his mother was gone, he said, but also the Corpsey Corps had asked his dad to help them with their inquiries, which meant that his dad was carted off in a black solar van, and now two female corpsers were snooping around the house and asking him a lot of stupid questions. Worst of all, Jimmy's mother had stolen Killer to let her loose in the wild. She'd left him a note about it. But the wild was totally wrong for Killer because she'd be eaten by bob kittens. "Oh, Jimmy," I said, "that's terrible." I put my arms around him and hugged him. He was sort of crying. I started crying too, and we stroked each other carefully, as if both of us had broken arms or diseases, and then we slid tenderly into my bed, still holding on to each other as if we were drowning, and we started kissing each other. I felt I was helping Jimmy, and he was helping me at the same time. It was like a feast day back at the gardeners when we'd do everything in a special way because it was in honor of something. That's what this was like. It was in honor. "I don't want to hurt you," Jimmy said. "Oh, Jimmy," I thought, "I'm putting light around you." Chapter 42. After that first time, I felt very happy, as if I was singing. Not a doleful song, more like a bird song. I loved being in bed with Jimmy. It made me feel so safe to have his arms around me, and it was amazing to me how slippery and silky one skin felt against another skin. The body has a wisdom of its own, Adam One used to say. He'd been talking about the immune system, but it was true in another way. That wisdom wasn't merely like singing, it was like dancing, only better. I was in love with Jimmy, and I had to believe that Jimmy was just as in love with me. I wrote in my diary, Jimmy. Then I underlined it in red and drew a red heart. I still distrusted writing enough not to put in everything that was happening, but each time we had sex, I drew another heart and colored it in. I wanted to phone Amanda and tell her about it, even though Amanda had said once that people telling you about their sex was as boring as people telling you about their dreams. But when I went into my closet and took out my plush tiger, the purple phone was no longer there. I felt cold all over. My diary was still inside the bear, where I'd hidden it. But I had no phone. Then Lucerne came into my room. She said, didn't I know that a phone inside the compound had to be registered, so people couldn't phone out industrial secrets? It was a crime to have an unregistered phone, and the Corpsey Corps could track such phones. Didn't I know that? I shook my head. Can they tell who was called? I said. She said they could trace the number, which could be really bad news for the callers at both ends. She didn't say really bad news. She said unfortunate consequences. Then she said that despite my obvious belief that she was a bad mother, she did have my best interests at heart. For instance, if she happened to find a purple phone with a frequently called number, she might leave a text message at that called number, such as, "Dump it." So if they did locate that second phone, it would be inside a dumpster. And she herself would dispose of the purple one. And now she was going to play golf, and she hoped I would think very carefully about what she'd just said. I did think very carefully. I thought, Lucerne went out of her way to save Amanda. She must have known that's who I was phoning. But she hates Amanda. So really, Lucerne went out of her way to save Zeb. Despite everything, she still loves him. Now that I was in love with Jimmy, I had more sympathy for Lucerne and the way she used to behave around Zeb. I could see how you could do extreme things for the person you loved. Adam One said that when you loved a person, that love might not always get returned the way you wanted, but it was a good thing anyway, because love went out all around you like an energy wave, and a creature you didn't even know would be helped by it. The example he used was of someone being killed by a virus and then eaten by vultures. I hadn't liked that comparison, but the general idea was true. Because here was Lucerne, sending that text message because she loved Zeb, but as a side effect, saving Amanda, which hadn't been her original intention. So Adam One was right. But meanwhile, I'd lost touch with Amanda. I felt very sad about that. Jimmy and I still did our homework together. Sometimes we really did do it, when there were other people around. The rest of the time, we didn't. It would take us about a minute to get out of our clothes and into each other, and Jimmy would be running his hands all over me and saying I was so slender, like a sylph. He liked words like that, not that I always knew what they meant. He said sometimes he felt like a child molester. Later I'd write down some of the things he'd said, as if they were prophecies. Jimmy is so great. He said I'm a sylph. I didn't care that much about spelling, only about the feeling. I loved him so much, but then I made a mistake. I asked him if he was still in love with Wakula, or did he love me instead? I shouldn't have asked that. He waited too long to answer, and then he said, "Did it matter?" I wanted to say yes, but instead I said no. Then Wakula Price moved to the West Coast, and Jimmy got moody and went back to spending more time with Glenn than he spent with me. So that was the answer, and it made me very unhappy. Despite that, we were still having sex, though not very often. The red hearts in my diary were getting farther and farther apart. Then I saw Jimmy by accident at the mall with this foul-mouthed older girl called Linda Lee, who was rumored to be going through all the boys at school one by one but fast, like eating soy nuts. Jimmy had his hand right on her ass, and then she pulled down his head and kissed him. It was a long, wet kiss. I felt sick to my stomach at the thought of Jimmy with her, and I remembered something Amanda once said about diseases, and I thought, whatever Linda Lee's got, I've got too. And I went home and threw up and cried, and then I got into my big white bathtub and had a warm bath, but it wasn't much comfort. Jimmy didn't know I knew about him and Linda Lee. A few days later, he asked if he could come over as usual, and I said yes. I wrote in my diary, "Jimmy, you nosy brat, I know you're reading this. I hate it. Just because I fucked you doesn't mean I like you, so stay out." Two red lines under hate, three under stay out. Then I left the diary on the top of my dresser. Your enemies could use your writing against you, I thought, but also you could use it against them. After the sex, I took a shower by myself, and when I came out, Jimmy was reading my diary and said, why did I hate him all of a sudden? So I told him. I used words I'd never said out loud before, and Jimmy said he was wrong for me. He was incapable of commitment because of Wakula Price. She turned him into an emotional dumpster, but maybe he was destructive by nature since he messed up every girl he touched. And I asked exactly how many that would be. I couldn't stand it that he would just include me in a big basket of girls as if we were peaches or turnips. Then he said he really liked me as a person, which was why he was being honest with me, and I told him to get stuffed. So we broke up on bad terms. The stretch of time after that was very dark. I wondered what I was doing on the earth. No one would care much if I wasn't on it anymore. Maybe I should cast away what Adam 1 called my husk and transform into a vulture or a worm. But then I remembered how the gardeners used to say, "Wren, your life is a precious gift. And where there is a gift, there is a giver. And when you've been given a gift, you should always say thank you." So that was some help. Also, I could hear Amanda's voice. "Why are you being so weak? Love's never a fair trade." "So Jimmy's tired of you, so what? There's guys all over the place like germs, and you can pick them like flowers and toss them away when they're wilted. But you have to act like you're having a spectacular time, and every day's a party." What I did next wasn't good, and I'm still ashamed of it. I walked up to Glenn in the cafeteria. It took a lot of courage because Glenn was so cool, he was practically frozen. And I asked him if he'd like to hang out with me. What I had in mind was that I'd have sex with Glenn, and Jimmy would find out and be wrecked. Not that I wanted sex with Glenn. It would be like shagging a salad server, kind of flat and wooden. Glenn said, "Hang out?" in a puzzled way. "Aren't you with Jimmy?" I said it was over, and anyway, it was never serious because Jimmy was such a clown. Then I blurted out the next thing that came into my head. "I saw you with the gardeners at the Tree of Life," I said. "Remember? I was the one who walked you over to see Pilar? With that honey?" He looked alarmed and said we should get a happy cappuccino and talk. We did talk. We talked a lot. We hung out in the mall so much that kids started saying we were a thing, but we weren't. It was never a romance. What was it, then? I guess Glenn was the only person at Healthwiser I could talk to about the gardeners, and it was the same for him. That was the bond. It was like being in a secret club. Maybe Jimmy was never my twin at all. Maybe it was Glenn, which is a strange thought because he was a strange guy, more like a cyborg, which was what Wakula Price used to call him. Were we friends? I wouldn't even call it that. Sometimes he looked at me as if I was an amoeba or some problem he was solving in nanobioforms. Glenn already knew quite a lot about the gardeners, but he wanted to know more. What it was like to live with them every day. What they did and said. What they really believed. He'd get me to sing the songs. He'd want me to repeat what Adam 1 said in his Saint and Feast Day speeches. Glenn never laughed at them the way Jimmy would have if I'd ever done that for him. Instead, he'd ask things like, "So they think we should use nothing except recycled? But what if the corp stopped making anything new? We'll run out." Sometimes he'd ask me more personal things like, "Would you eat animals if you were starving?" And, "Do you think the waterless flood is really going to happen?" But I didn't always know the answers. He'd talk about other things, too. One day he said that what you had to do in any adversarial situation was to kill the king, as in chess. I said people didn't have kings anymore. He said he meant the center of power, but today it wouldn't be a single person. It would be the technological connections. I said, "You mean like coding and splicing?" And he said, "Something like that." Once he asked me if I thought God was a cluster of neurons, and if so, whether people having that cluster had been passed down by natural selection because it conferred a competitive edge, or whether maybe it was just a spandrel, such as having red hair, which didn't matter one way or another to your survival chances. A lot of the time I felt way out of my depth with him, so I'd say, "What do you think?" He always had an answer to that. Jimmy did see us together at the mall, and he did seem taken aback, though not for long, because I caught him giving Glenn a thumbs up, as if saying, "Go for it, buddy, be my guest," as if I was his property and he was sharing. Jimmy and Glenn graduated 2 years before I did and went off to college. Glenn went to Watson Crick with all the brainiacs, and Jimmy went to the Martha Graham Academy, which was for kids with no math and science potential. So at least I didn't have to watch Jimmy at school anymore, coming on to this or that new girl. But it was almost worse with Jimmy not there than with him there. I put in the next 2 years somehow. My marks were poor, and I didn't think I'd get in anywhere for college. I'd end up as a minimum wage meat slave working at Secret Burgers or somewhere like that. But Lucerne pulled some strings. I heard her talking about it to one of her golf club friends. "She's not stupid, but that cult experience ruined her motivation, so the Martha Graham Academy is the best we could do." So I'd be in the same space with Jimmy. That made me so nervous I felt sick. The night before I left on the sealed bullet train, I reread my old diary. And then I knew what the gardeners meant when they said, "Be careful what you write." There were my own words from the time when I was so happy, except that now it was torture to read them. I took the diary down the street and around the corner and shoved it into a garboil dumpster. It would turn into oil, and then all those red hearts I'd drawn would go up in smoke. But at least they would be useful along the way. Part of me thought I would find Jimmy again at Martha Graham, and he would say it was me he'd loved all along, and could we get back together? And I'd forgive him, and everything would be wonderful the way it had been at first. But the other part of me realized that the chances of that were nothing. Adam 1 used to say that people can believe two opposite things at the same time, and now I knew it was true.
The Feast of Serpent Wisdom, Year 18. Of the Importance of Instinctive Knowing, spoken by Adam 1.
Dear friends, fellow mortals, fellow creatures. Today is our feast of serpent wisdom, and our children have once again excelled in their decoration. We have Amanda and Shackleton to thank for the gripping mural of the fox snake ingesting a frog, an apt reminder to us of the intertwined nature of the dance of life. For this feast, we traditionally feature the zucchini, a serpent-shaped vegetable. Thanks to Rebecca, our Eve 11, for her innovative zucchini and radish dessert slice. We are certainly looking forward to it. But first, I must alert you to the fact that certain individuals have been making unofficial inquiries about Zeb, our many-talented Adam 7. In our father's garden, there are many species, and it takes all kinds to make an ecosystem, and Zeb has chosen the non-violent option. So if questioned, do keep in mind that "I don't know" is always the best answer. Our text for Serpent Wisdom is from Matthew 10:16. "Be ye therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves." To those former biologists among us who have made a study either of serpents or of doves, this sentence is puzzling. Serpents are expert hunters, paralyzing or strangling and crushing their prey, a gift that enables them to predate many mice and rats. Yet, despite their natural technology, one would not ordinarily call serpents wise. And doves, though harmless to us, are extremely aggressive to other doves. A male will harass and kill a less dominant male if occasion offers. The Spirit of God is sometimes pictured as a dove, which simply informs us that this spirit is not always peaceful. It has a ferocious side to it as well. The serpent is a highly charged symbol throughout the human words of God, though its guises are varied. Sometimes it is shown as an evil enemy of humankind, perhaps because when our primate ancestors slept in trees, the constrictors were among their few nocturnal predators. And for these ancestors, shoeless as they were, to step on a viper meant certain death. Yet the serpent is also equated with Leviathan, that great water beast God made to humble mankind and also named to Job as an awe-inspiring example of his inventiveness. Among the ancient Greeks, serpents were sacred to the god of healing. In other religions, the serpent with its tail in its mouth refers to the cycle of life and to the beginning and end of time. Because they shed their skins, serpents have also symbolized renewal, the soul casting off its old self from which it emerges resplendent. A complicated symbol indeed. Therefore, how are we to be wise as serpents? Are we to eat our own tails, or tempt people to wrongdoing, or coil around our enemies and squeeze them to death? Surely not, because in the same sentence we are told to be as harmless as doves. Serpent wisdom, I propose, is the wisdom of feeling directly, as the serpent feels vibrations in the earth. The serpent is wise in that it lives in immediacy, without the need for the elaborate intellectual frameworks humankind is endlessly constructing for itself. For what in us is belief and faith, in the other creatures is inborn knowledge. No human can truly know the full mind of God. The human reason is a pin dancing on the head of an angel, so small is it in comparison to the divine vastness that encircles us. As the human words of God have put it, "Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen." That is the point, not seen. We cannot know God by reason and measurement. Indeed, excess reason and measurement lead to doubt. Through them, we know that comets and nuclear holocausts are among the possible tomorrows, not to mention the waterless flood that we fear looms ever nearer. This fear dilutes our certainty, and through that channel comes loss of faith. And then the temptation to enact malevolence enters our souls. For if annihilation awaits us, why bother to strive for the good? We humans must labor to believe, as the other creatures do not. They know the dawn will come. They can sense it, that ruffling of the half-light, the horizon bestirring itself. Not only every sparrow, not only every raccoon, but every nematode and mollusk and octopus and mohair and liobomb, all are held in the palm of his hand. Unlike us, they have no need for faith. As for the serpent, who can tell where its head ends and its body begins? It experiences God in all parts of itself. It feels the vibrations of divinity that run through the earth and responds to them quicker than thought. This, then, is the serpent wisdom we long for, this wholeness of being. May we greet with joy the few moments when, through grace, and by the aid of our retreats and vigils and the assistance of God's botanicals, we are granted an apprehension of it. Let us sing, God gave unto the animals.
God gave unto the animals a wisdom past our power to see. Each knows innately how to live, which we must learn laboriously. The creatures need no lesson books, for God instructs their minds and souls. The sunlight hums to every bee, the moist clay whispers to the mole. And each one seeks its meat from God, and each enjoys the earth's sweet
and
fare.
Each one seeks its meat from God, and each enjoys the earth's sweet
but none does sell, and none does buy, and none does file its proper
land.
None
does sell, and none does buy, and none does file its proper
The serpent
land.
Is an arrow bright that feels the earth's vibrations fine, and through its armored shining flesh, and all along its twining spine. I were like serpents wise to sense the wholeness of the whole.
I were like serpents wise to sense the wholeness of the whole.
Not only with the thinking brain, but with the swift and ardent
Not
soul.
Only with the thinking brain, but with the swift and ardent
God
soul.
God gave unto the animals a wisdom past our power to
God
see.
God gave unto the animals a wisdom past our power to
Each
see.
Knows innately how to live, which we must learn laboriously.
God gave unto the animals. God gave unto the animals.
God gave unto the animals.
God gave unto the animals.
God gave unto the animals.
God gave unto
Chapter 43. Toby. The Feast of Serpent Wisdom. Year 25. The Feast of Serpent Wisdom. Old Moon. Toby enters the feast day and the moon phase on her pink notepaper with the winky eyes and kissy lips. Old Moon is a pruning week, said the gardeners. Plant by the new, slash by the old. A good time to apply sharp tools to yourself. Hack off any extraneous parts that might need trimming. Your head, for instance. A joke, she says out loud. She should avoid such morbid thoughts. Today she will pare her fingernails. Toenails as well. They shouldn't be permitted to run rampant. She could give herself a manicure. There are lots of cosmetic supplies in this place, whole shelves of them. A new you luscious polish. A new you plum skin plumper. A new you fountain of youth, total immersion. Shed that scaly epidermis. But why bother to polish or plump or shed? But why not bother? Either choice is equally pointless. Do it for you, a new you used to croon. The new you. I could have a whole new me, thinks Toby. Yet another whole new me, fresh as a snake. How many would that add up to by now? She trudges up the stairs to the rooftop, hoists her binoculars, surveys her visible realm. There's motion in the weeds, over by the forest edge. Could it be the pigs? If so, they're keeping a low profile. Vultures are still clustering around the dead boar. There'll be lots of nanobioforms at work on it. It must be getting ripe by now. Here's something different. Closer to the building, a clump of sheep is grazing. 5 of them. 3 mohairs, a green one, a pink one, and a bright purple one, and 2 other sheep that appear to be conventional. The long hair of the mohairs isn't in good shape. There are clot-like snarls in it and twigs and dry leaves. On screen, in advertisements, their hair had been shiny. You'd see the sheep tossing its hair, then a beautiful girl tossing a mane of the same hair. More hair with mohair. But they're not faring so well without their salon treatments. The sheep clump together, lift their heads. Toby sees why. Crouching low in the weeds, 2 liobams are on the hunt. Maybe the sheep smell them, but the scent must be confusing, part lion, part lamb. The purple mohair is the most jittery. Don't look like prey, Toby thinks at it. Sure enough. It's the purple one the liobams go after. They cut it out from the group and chase it for a short distance. The pathetic beast is impeded by its coiffure. It looks like a purple fright wig on legs, and the liobams quickly pull it down. Finding the throat under all that hair padding takes them a while, and the mohair scrambles to its feet several times before the liobams finish it off. Then they settle down to eat. The other sheep have run awkwardly away in a muddle of bleating, but now they're grazing again. She'd intended to do some gardening today, pick some greens. Her stock of preserved and dried foods is waning like the moon. But she decides against it because of the liobams. Cats of all kinds will set ambushes. One frisks around in the open to distract your attention, while another one slips quietly up behind. In the afternoon, she takes a nap. An old moon draws the past, said Pilar. Whatever arrives from the shadows, you must greet as a blessing. And the past does come back to her. The white frame house of her childhood. The ordinary trees. The woodland in the background, tinged with blue as if there's haze. A deer is outlined against it, standing rigid as a lawn ornament, ears pricked. Her father's digging with a shovel over by the pile of picket fencing. Her mother's a momentary glimpse at the kitchen window. Perhaps she's making soup. Everything tranquil, as if it would never end. But where is Toby in this picture? For it is a picture. It's flat, like a picture on a wall. She's not there. She opens her eyes, tears on her cheeks. I wasn't in the picture because I'm the frame, she thinks. It's not really the past. It's only me holding it all together. It's only a handful of fading neural pathways. It's only a mirage. Surely I was an optimistic person back then, she thinks. Back there, I woke up whistling. I knew there were things wrong in the world. They were referred to. I'd seen them in the on-screen news. But the wrong things were wrong somewhere else. By the time she'd reached college, the wrongness had moved closer. She remembers the oppressive sensation, like waiting all the time for a heavy stone footfall, then the knock at the door. Everybody knew. Nobody admitted to knowing. If other people began to discuss it, you tuned them out, because what they were saying was both so obvious and so unthinkable. We're using up the earth. It's almost gone. You can't live with such fears and keep on whistling. The waiting builds up in you like a tide. You start wanting it to be done with. You find yourself saying to the sky, just do it. Do your worst. Get it over with. She could feel the coming tremor of it running through her spine, asleep or awake. It never went away. Even among the gardeners. Especially as time wore on, among the gardeners.